Rising Up with Sonali. Sonali Kohatkar talks to Marxist economist Richard Wolff about his new book, Understanding Marxism.
From KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. In today's news headlines, President Donald Trump's former attorney and fixer, Michael Cohen, returns to Capitol Hill on Wednesday for a fourth day of testimony in front of the House Intelligence Committee. The hearing will take place behind closed doors and is likely to focus on Russian interference and Trump's finances. Also possibly being raised is the issue of presidential pardons and whether Trump administration officials dangled a potential pardon to Cohen when he was first in the special counsel's crosshairs. Meanwhile, in New York, the state's Department of Financial Services has issued subpoenas for Trump's insurance brokers on Tuesday. The move was unrelated to other investigations and indicates that Trump's finances in New York are also under scrutiny. The Washington Post summarized that Tuesday was a case study in Trump's new reality of besiegement, as multiplying investigations by state authorities, federal investigators, and congressional Democrats began to dig into his business, charity, and presidency simultaneously. The rate of immigrants arriving at the U.S.-Mexico border has sharply increased in recent months, breaking previously set records. There are nearly twice as many people attempting to cross the border as there were a year ago. In February alone, there were 76,000 people who crossed the border without papers, a number that defied the harsh anti-immigrant policies being enforced under Trump. It is the highest such number in 11 years and indicates the increased insecurity facing Central Americans especially. At a press conference on Tuesday, Kevin K. McAleenan, Customs and Border Protection Commissioner, said this.
Unlike historical crossings, which are comprised of a large majority of single adult males from Mexico who could be repatriated quickly, families and children from Central America require increased care and processing and are released into the United States pending adjudication of their immigration claims. These solutions are temporary, and this situation is not sustainable.
That's Kevin McAleenan, Customs and Border Protection Commissioner, speaking to reporters on Tuesday. In other news, J.P. Morgan Chase has decided to back out of financing private prisons and detention centers. The big bank is one of several that had financed such notorious private prison companies as Geo Group and CoreCivic. Wells Fargo has also apparently pulled back from financing private prisons. Both banks had faced strong political pressure from grassroots activists demanding that they divest from the private prison industry. Late in his tenure, President Barack Obama had decided to phase out the industry altogether, but only 1 month after becoming president, Trump reversed that order. In a related story, the investigative media outlet Axios has determined that of all the nonprofit shelters that house undocumented children in the U.S., only three are linked to more than half of all recently revealed sexual abuse allegations. Facilities run by Southwest Key were the sites of 65 accusations of sexual abuse of undocumented children, while Baptist Child and Family Services had 23 accusations and International Educational Services had 14. These three organizations have received $2.5 billion of federal government contracts over the past 4 years. In Alabama, reproductive justice and women's rights advocates are up in arms over a judge's recent decision to give an aborted fetus the same rights as a person. A man named Ryan Magers of Madison County, Alabama, had learned that his girlfriend had had a medication-induced abortion at 6 weeks into her pregnancy. Magers, with the help of an anti-abortion organization, petition to become the personal representative of the aborted fetus. And on Tuesday, the county probate judge, Frank Barger, granted his petition in the first such move of its kind nationwide. The case is the first consequence of a state constitutional amendment passed last year, recognizing the, quote, rights of unborn children. One women's rights advocate, Erin Mattson of the group Repro Action, tweeted in response to Tuesday's decision, "This is the logical consequence of all anti-abortion activity. Fetuses are treated like people, and women and people who can become pregnant are not." A major protest earlier this week in Sacramento against the police shooting of a black man named Stephon Clark resulted in 84 arrests. Authorities announced late last week that the officers who shot the unarmed Clark 20 times would not be charged. Among those arrested at the protest late Monday was Sacramento Bee journalist Dale Kaysler, who was later released. The protest took place outside a Trader Joe's in a wealthy neighborhood. The Sacramento Bee reported that the East Sacramento location was chosen because it is one of the wealthiest neighborhoods in the city of Sacramento and home to many influential leaders in city and state government. A day after the protest, on Tuesday, activists stormed a meeting at City Hall demanding action on Stephon Clark's killing and denouncing the harsh police response on Monday night.
Police officers, that's it, they're going to like this every time.
Leave him alone!
Every time!
Leave him alone!
Leave him alone!
Leave him alone!
Back off!
Leave him alone!
Back off!
Stand still!
Those are the sounds of a protest at City Hall in Sacramento, California, where police were not charged in the killing of an unarmed 22-year-old black man named Stephon Clark. An 18-year-old man from Ohio testified in front of Congress on Tuesday about his journey to getting vaccinated with a mother who believes vaccines cause autism. Ethan Lindenberger of Norwalk, Ohio, spoke to lawmakers at a hearing examining the recent outbreaks of the virulent measles virus in the states of Washington and Oregon. Once he turned 18, Lindenberger got himself vaccinated.
I approached my mother numerous times trying to explain that vaccines are safe and that my family should be vaccinated, approaching even with articles in the CDC explicitly claiming that ideas that vaccines cause autism and extremely dangerous consequences were incorrect. In one such instance where I approached my mother with information from the CDC that claimed vaccines do not cause autism, she responded with, "That's what they want you to think." Skepticism and worry were taking the forefront in terms of information.
That's Ethan Lindenberger speaking to Congress on Tuesday about misinformation on vaccines. Democrats have moved to reinstate net neutrality rules with plans to unveil new legislation on Wednesday. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced that her party would work to pass the Save the Internet Act. The Republican-controlled Senate had already passed the bill last May. A Republican-controlled Federal Communications Commission had voted 3-2 in December 2017 to repeal Obama-era net neutrality rules. And in international news, North Korea has found to be rebuilding its ability to launch satellites and its intercontinental ballistic missile program. The reports were based on U.S. and South Korean intelligence and, according to the New York Times, quote, could be a first sign that North Korea is preparing to end its moratorium on missile tests, which Mr. Trump has claimed is a major diplomatic achievement. And that does it for our headlines today. On today's show, one of the nation's leading Marxist economists, Richard Wolff, has written a new book called Simply Understanding Marxism. Dr. Wolff will join us for an in-depth discussion of the book and of the renewed interest in Marx's work and socialism. Stay tuned. KPFK Pacifica Radio. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Socialism has become the new old bogeyman of the conservative moneyed classes in the U.S. The fear of socialism stems directly from its growing popularity among those left behind by our current capitalist system. The ideas behind socialism and capitalism go back centuries, and most of us today lack a clear understanding of these systems. Now, one of the leading Marxist economists in the U.S. has written a new book exploring the ideas of Karl Marx. It has been more than 200 years since Marx's birth, more than 170 years since the publication of his book, The Communist Manifesto, with Friedrich Engels, and more than 150 years since his own seminal and influential book, Das Kapital. Yet Marx remains misunderstood to this day. Richard Wolff is a visiting professor at the New School University in New York, a professor of economics emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and the author of a number of books, including Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism, Occupy the Economy, Challenging Capitalism, Imagine Living in a Socialist USA, and Capitalism's Crisis Deepens, Essays on the Global Economic Meltdown. He now joins me to discuss his latest book called simply Understanding Marxism. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Sonali. Glad to be here.
So immediately when I started looking through your book, three questions jumped out at me, which is, how does one define Marxism? What is the difference between Marxism and socialism? And was Marx a Marxist? So I'm not going to throw all three of those at you at once, but let's just start with the idea of defining Marxism, since your book is specifically about that. This is a term based on one particular individual named Marx. So what is Marxism?
Well, the best way to describe it is a kind of tradition of thinking that goes back to the work of Karl Marx. He was born in 1818, he died in 1883. In other words, he lived across the 19th century. He was not the first socialist or communist by a long shot. He came after that kind of movement had already gotten underway, but he became the kind of seminal thinker who produced a great deal of work, essays, books of all kinds. And so basically, it's the most developed tradition of thought within and about socialism and capitalism and how they differ that we have. And it has been inspirational on a scale that is really stunning. You don't have very many examples in the history of the world like this. He was born in Germany. But because he became politically active as a young man, he was exiled from Germany and actually spent most of his life in London, working with and in the English language and producing an extraordinary volume of work. But what's really interesting is that it must have been the right work at the right time, because it spread, as I say, extraordinarily. Even in his lifetime, much of Europe and beyond that, places like the United States and the British colonies were catching on to his work. In the 100 years, a little over 100 years since he died, his work has spread to every country on the face of the earth. There are Marxist associations, Marxist political movements, Marxist political parties, and, for example, the government of the largest by population country on Earth, the People's Republic of China, is officially a Marxist government. So it has spread all over the world. Of course, if you spread in a short time, and 100 or 125 years is, believe me, a very short time historically, and you spread across the world all these different histories and cultures and economic conditions, you end up, as has happened to many traditions, with alternative interpretations of what Marx wrote. That's why I use the word tradition, because it includes people who disagree with one another, often quite considerably. It's a little bit like talking about the Christian tradition Because there are different kinds of interpretations of the Bible, for example, different understandings, debates and disagreements. You have all of that inside Marxism too. But if I could very briefly define it, it's the notion that the history of the world is comprised of a sequence of economic systems, that human beings have approached economic systems pretty much the way they've approached everything else. They are grateful for what they have, but they're always looking for a way to do it better. That's why we evolved our political systems, our educational systems, our family systems. And the notion of Marxism is the economic systems, likewise, are a kind of trial and error. And that capitalism, being the most recent one, ought to be confronted with the same intellectual curiosity, the same notion of asking the question, can we do better than what we've inherited from the past? And the basic Marxian answer is an enthusiastic yes. Capitalism should not be thought of as the end of history, the point at which we no longer ask these questions. The notion of Marxism is, let's take a look at capitalism and let's figure out whether we need another system, what it might look like, and how we're going to get there.
So Marx's critique of capitalism, as we call Marxism now, one might argue, was crafted at a very different time. You know, in the 1800s, you didn't have the same kind of successes of capitalism or achievements of capitalism that hardcore capitalist defenders like to tout, and that they might say you can't apply those same critiques today. But can you?
Well, I would argue that they're right. You can't apply the same critiques. But Mr. Marx was one of those seminal thinkers that kind of understood things on a scale that even though the details change and the context changes, there are some basic insights. For example, in conventional economics, as it's taught in American universities, students are required to read the works, for example, of Adam Smith or David Ricardo or John Stuart Mill, or more recently, John Maynard Keynes, or even more recently, Paul Samuelson. It's not that the conditions haven't changed since those people wrote, for sure they have, but that there is the conviction that their level of insight is a very good place to start. And so all that the Marxian tradition has done is use Marx's work as a starting point, but never being satisfied in some general way with the original insights. It's a matter of interpreting and then adjusting and updating them to see what kinds of insights they can provide to the problems of capitalism now.
So Marx's critique of capitalism hit a strong nerve during his lifetime, which is why his work became so influential. Are you finding that today that those same critiques are hitting a nerve? Are people rediscovering Marx and Marxism? Are they looking back at those critiques and realizing that many of them do apply today, that that interest, that resurgence of interest in socialism is spreading to, you know, towards people who are looking up, who was Karl Marx?
Exactly. That's one of the reasons I wrote this book, because so many people were asking me, either through my radio and TV programs or in my public speaking. Yes, absolutely. The renewal of interest in socialism is leading people, as anyone who studies this material knew it would, to the greatest thinker that we ever had in this field, which is Marx, and the many thinkers since then who have acknowledged with intellectual honesty the influence upon them and their work of what they got from reading Marx and some of the leading Marxists since. So yes, and I expect that very much to continue. And the reasons, by the way, might be important to understand. Has capitalism changed? For sure. But does capitalism exhibit some of the basic reasons why Marx himself became a critic? And the answer is likewise, sure. And let me mention just two. Capitalism produces a stunning level of inequality. Today, Mr. Jeffrey Bezos, the CEO of Amazon, boasts that he has a personal fortune of $150 billion. That's more wealth than many countries around the world have. This is a level of inequality that you'd have to go back to ancient Egypt and the pharaohs to get that again. Capitalism, instead of making us less unequal, has demonstrated that it is a system prone to extraordinary inequality. Oxfam in England released a report recently indicating that the richest 100 people on this planet together have more wealth than the bottom half of the population of the planet, roughly 3.5 billion people. This is an extraordinary situation. Marx was very critical of the inequality reproduced by capitalism. And the other big issue for Marx was capitalism's instability. You know, we had a great crash in the 1930s. Now we've had another great crash starting in 2008. And the effects of that are with us right as we speak. Marx also points out that capitalism, wherever it settles, has a cycle. Every 4 to 7 years, it tanks. Millions of people are thrown out of work. Thousands of enterprises go belly up. Poverty stalks the countryside. Inequality worsens. This is a system whose inequality and instability should long ago have projected onto the mass of people the importance of asking the question, can we do better? And to that question, Marxism as a tradition remains one of the great resources for answers.
So when he was critiquing capitalism, he applied that critique to feudalism and slavery institutions that still existed at the time when he was writing. And so today we might be able to expand that same analysis to what we sometimes call wage slavery, right?
Right. Marx enjoyed using that phrase because he wanted to, in a short, pithy kind of way, get across to people that there were similarities between capitalism, feudalism, and slavery, which, if you faced them, would help you understand both the need for and the possibility of going further. Let me briefly explain. Slavery is a system that organizes the production of goods and services into two basic roles, master, slave. The slave does all the work, and the master controls it all and takes the output, returning to the slave enough to keep the slave going because he wants this system to reproduce itself over time. Feudalism does not allow one person to own another, as we did have in slavery, but feudalism is like slavery in, again, dividing the people engaged in the production of goods and services into two roles, lord and serf. The serfs do all the work. The lords live in the luxurious homes that is part of the work that the serfs have to do. Now we come to capitalism. When it came into existence, basically starting in England back in the 16th and 17th centuries, it pretended, and I believe it was an honest effort. I don't mean pretense in the sense of deliberately saying something that isn't true, but they thought at that time that they were putting behind them this dichotomy, slave, master, serf, lord. But the irony, and this is one of Marx's insights, is that capitalism thought it was breaking from those systems, but it wasn't in reality. It was just changing the form. In capitalism, you don't have master-slave, you don't have lord and serf, but you have the rough equivalent, namely employer and employee. The employer directs and controls, the employer gets the profits, even though everybody, especially the employees, have done the work to produce those profits, but we allow them to be taken by a very small subset of the people involved in production. And that's pretty much what slavery and feudalism did as well. And that's Marx's way of saying, look, the employee is a wage slave, suggesting, as he wanted to, that we see in capitalism not the end of human history, but another phase of a dichotomy between those who control and those who are controlled, which is the problem. We have to get beyond it. And Marx points the direction, that's all he really does, points the direction of what it might mean to go beyond a system like capitalism, whose employer-employee relationship account for the inequality that it constantly reproduces and the instability that attends the system.
Right. I mean, essentially, it's by design that inequality is baked into the system. And I just want to read from your book where you explain that so well. You write, the employer believes that employing you, as with all other productive laborers hired, will add quality and or quantity to the enterprise's output of ladders and thus more sales revenue as well. So Marx explains an employer will only pay a productive worker $20 an hour if during that hour more than $20 worth of sales revenue results. And so we essentially have baked into that an inequality between employer and employee. So the defenders of capitalism, Richard, would say, well, the employee is welcome to start their own enterprise and exploit those below him or her. And that's how you get innovation and creation, and greed drives society and progress, and you can't have it any other way.
Yes, you know, that's really interesting, because those arguments were made in Marx's time, and for better or worse, we do have Marx's response. He was a sharp debater and went right after those folks. And in regard to the notion of greed and so forth as an incentive, Marx was very clever and referred to that often as an insult to the human race, the notion that the only reason human beings try to figure out better ways to do things would be if they could personally profit from doing so. And he mocked all of that and made reference to the abundant anthropological literature at that time, showing that every kind of society for which we have any kind of record indicates that human beings had a tendency to try to do things better, to learn to use tools, to learn to use machines, to develop cooperation, because they understood that if they cooperated with one another, they'd all be better off, rather than cooperating to get one person better off. In other words, the notion that you have to have a capitalist system to have economic development may be very comforting to capitalists, but it has no grounding in the history of the human race, and is a kind of an insult that imagines human beings never thought in terms of community, never thought in terms of teamwork. And Marx, and I myself, I follow in this particular way, I always find it remarkable that the same people who will go to a sports event and really enjoy and understand and celebrate something they call teamwork, then seem to imagine that it couldn't be other than the opposite of that in the world of economics, where everybody has to be motivated only by their own immediate personal advantage relative to other people. And I also think that, you know, that if you look at the historical record, many of the great inventions that we are now taking for granted were produced by people who didn't anticipate and did not get very much in the way of personal advancement or gain from what they did, but had instead an aesthetic satisfaction, a sense of community involvement, a sense of giving back to the community that educated and nurtured them as children. All the complex motives that make people be and do what they do are a testimony to the narrow apologetics that imagine you can only get human progress if you make people personally, selfishly motivated.
Now, Richard, the defenders of capitalism have said and still say that they, thinking of so many Republicans who are very frightened of socialism today, they say, well, we don't, these socialists want to redistribute wealth so that everybody gets a smaller piece of the pie. We want to grow the pie. We want a rising tide lifts all boat. And there's this notion that capitalism increases the wealth of society so that all the surpluses that are created trickle down to the rest of us. And I guess we were sold that same bill of lies about the tax reform bill, which now we know that corporations took all of their benefits from government intervention and kept them, put them in offshore accounts, didn't create jobs with them. How do the defenders of capitalism continue to justify this system when it's so clear that the surpluses simply get stored and they build bigger and bigger mountains of wealth like Bezos, who you were mentioning?
Yes, I think it's in a way the key question that you're asking. How do they hold on? Let me comment a little bit as follows. I was struck recently by an NBC Wall Street Journal poll that found that 25% of voters today believe that if a candidate running for office says that he or she is a socialist, that's a plus. In other words, they're attracted to a candidate who says that. The reason I was struck by that is that we are citizens of a country that has demonized everything having to do with socialism uninterruptedly for the last 75 years, just short of a century. With the end of World War II in 1945, that demonization got going on a stunning scale. And what it has done is kind of produced a black and white universe, particularly for the older people in our society, who believe that sort of everything bad is associated with socialism and everything good is associated with capitalism. That's the fruit of the Cold War. You kind of had the reverse absurdity over there in the Soviet Union, and for the same parallel kinds of reasons. Normal human being, when they realize or they think about economics, are looking for the strengths and the weaknesses. Let's have an intelligent conversation about the strengths and weaknesses of one system, capitalism, and compare it to the strengths and weaknesses of another system, socialism, communism, whatever you like. And then let's make an evaluation. That would be the reasonable way to go forward. But in the tensions of the Cold War, all of that was thrown aside so that you didn't look at the details, you didn't face the facts. You constantly reassured yourself in the United States that communism is bad and capitalism is good, and in the Soviet Union, vice versa. I think the irony here is that a new generation rising up, a generation that did not live in the Cold War, that never went through the transformation of having the Soviet Union be the ally of the United States fighting fascism in World War II to become the arch enemy literally within months after the end of the war, never went through any of that, was recently pointed out to me that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was born after the Cold War, or literally as the Cold War was ending. So her entire formation and that of the generation she's a part of is brought up without the hysterical black and white kind of mentality that we had. And the older you go in American society, all the polls show that, the more thinking of capitalism versus socialism as a displacement of the question good versus bad, that's something that older you get, the more you get it. And the younger you go in our population, the less likelihood is of seeing that.
Right.
And let me drive it home with one particular example. You know, there are many criticisms that can be made and should be made, both of the Soviet Union before and of the People's Republic of China now. Those are in order, like criticisms of any system should be put forward, and they can be done, and they can be made, and they have things about their society that need criticism. Many of the people in those societies voice such criticism. But here's a simple fact, which I, as an economist, cannot pretend is not the case. In the 20th century, the most spectacular example of economic growth, going from being a poor country to being a much, much richer country in a relatively short amount of time, the number one example in the 20th century is the Soviet Union. And in the 21st century, the 20 years that we have of that century up until this moment, the most spectacular example is the People's Republic of China. You can jump up and down and you can say what you want, but in the pressure to go from poverty to comfort, to have a standard of living that is enables you to educate your children and lead a healthy life, these societies have achieved something that puts them on the map of something to be taken seriously and not to be dismissed by some old ideological either-or-ness that wasn't a good idea back then and is downright ridiculous now.
Right. So finally, Richard, it seems as though the only way that in the United States we can dismiss socialism or Marxism is through propaganda, which is exactly what the Red Scare was all about. And we're seeing that revived again today with the critiques of socialism, you know, this massive fear that they're sowing about the Green New Deal. There won't be any planes. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is coming for your hamburgers. They're going to kill all the cows. And of course, the base laps it up, the base of the conservatives and Trump and others laps up these lies. So it seems as the only way to really undermine socialism and Marxist critique of capitalism is through propaganda and lies.
Yeah, it is. It's a very interesting revival by Mr. Trump, who is older and comes out of that generation, of the old Cold War patterns. But I really do feel, and it's not just wishful thinking, that with young people, and you know, I continue to teach in the university, so I'm constantly talking to people in the ages of 18 to 25. Among young people, what is hard reality for them is that the capitalist system isn't working. They're not seeing the kinds of jobs they hoped for. They're loading up with debts they cannot afford. They're surrounded by political actors who inspire disgust, not respect. For them, capitalism isn't working. And whatever else you say, they want to see alternatives and they want to think about them. And the reason interest in socialism and Marxism are rising is because they have the traditional alternatives to offer, the traditional criticisms to offer, and that is speaking to the younger people. And by younger, I'm now talking about roughly the younger half of the population. So Mr. Trump and his allies are repeating old stories, but the passage of time is removing the audience for those stories while it's building the audience for what the book Understanding Marxism is trying to get across.
Richard, thank you as always for joining us and spending this time with us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sonali, and I appreciate your interest in this kind of work.
My guest has been Richard Wolff, visiting professor at the New School University, New York, professor of economics emeritus at UMass Amherst. He's written a number of books, and we've been discussing his latest called Simply Understanding Marxism. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Minnesota Representative Ilhan Omar is once more in the crosshairs of her own party after making comments about Israel and its influence on American lawmakers. At a town hall meeting last week, Omar reportedly said that the pro-Israel lobby encourages, quote, allegiance to a foreign country, and that the charge of anti-Semitism that she and others face is, quote, designed to end the debate about Palestinian rights. Fellow Democrat Elliot Engel labeled her comments as a, quote, vile anti-Semitic slur. Omar, who some weeks ago apologized for a different set of comments on the same topic, shot back on Twitter, this time writing, I am told every day that I am anti-American if I am not pro-Israel. I find that to be problematic, and I am not alone. I just happen to be willing to speak up on it and open myself up to attacks. Now, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and other senior Democrats are planning to bring a vote to the House floor on Wednesday addressing the issue of anti-Semitism, but not mentioning Omar by name. When Ilhan Omar was attacked in February, we spoke with Ariel Gold, the co-director of Code Pink, and today we'll re-air that conversation. Michelle Goldberg, writing in the New York Times, pointed out that there is obviously, and we know this, there is a history of anti-Jewish racism in the world and in the country. There are stereotypes that have pervaded the political discourse, that often pervade the right, especially among Trump supporters. She pointed out, she wrote in this piece in the New York Times, she said, it's hardly radical to point out that lobbyist money has pernicious political effects, and I certainly have no problem with denunciations of AIPAC, which plays a malign role in pushing American policy in the Middle East to the right. But then she added, but at a moment when activists have finally pried open space in American politics to question our relationship with Israel, it's particularly incumbent on Israel's legitimate critics to avoid anything that smacks of anti-Jewish bigotry and the idea of Jews as global puppet masters using their financial savvy to make the Gentiles do their bidding clearly does. What do you make of that?
Well, that's not at all what Ilhan Omar's tweet said. Ilhan Omar's tweet said that money is controlling members of Congress. That doesn't apply just to AIPAC. That also applies to the NRA, to weapons companies, which are also linked to Israel, but to so many PACs. And let's face it, what's happening here is basically any attempt to smear the leaders in Congress, like Ilhan Omar, who are progressive on so many issues, who have pried open this question of criticizing Israel. Ilhan Omar is also one of the leaders in working to end U.S. support for the Saudi-led war on Yemen. She's one of the few members of Congress who's been brave enough to speak out against a U.S. orchestrated coup in Venezuela. So these are forces of establishment, forces of the status quo, and Israeli occupation apologists who are looking for excuses to find false accusations of anti-Semitism so that they can bring down one of the real front runners in moving our policy towards more progressive positions.
Does the conspiracy theory industry that churns out these tropes of, well, this is more Soros-funded, George Soros-funded activism, is that closer to what you would consider anti-Semitic?
Absolutely. What Ilhan Omar was referring to was something very specific, that of course lobbying has to do with money. And the actual tweet that she wrote, "It's all about the Benjamins, baby," is from a hip-hop song.
Yeah, Puff Daddy.
Yes.
So this particular firestorm that has essentially resulted in Ilhan Omar being forced to apologize partly came from pressure that she felt from her own party members. Let's talk about how AIPAC does influence members of both parties and how leader Nancy Pelosi was among the ones that basically shut her down.
Well, this was really despicable of Pelosi. We're talking about the same woman who just, I believe it was last Friday, just follow Donald Trump in recognizing Juan Guaido as the interim president of Venezuela. So this is somebody who just took a war hawk position. And I think Pelosi might be intimidated by all of these rising progressive stars. And absolutely, you know, AIPAC has for so long had a stranglehold on Congress. And we've seen that grip that AIPAC has on Congress slipping in the past years. So this was a real attempt to reassert that the Democratic Party will not move towards a position of working for Palestinian rights. And that's horrific.
AIPAC sponsors trips for members of Congress to Israel, right?
Absolutely. And this year, for the first time, we've seen Rashida Tlaib say she'll be rejecting the trip and that she'll be leading a trip of her own. Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has also said that she will be skipping the AIPAC trip. And we've seen a lot of backlash against Rashida Tlaib for this, for saying that she wants people not to go on a propaganda trip, for saying herself that she doesn't want to go on a propaganda trip and that she would like to offer members of Congress an opportunity to see the reality of the situation on the ground that Palestinians live under, the occupation. You know, we've seen members of Congress now trying to block her trip. And so there have been a series of attacks on both Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar. And what I would say happened this time with this tweet is these occupation apologists really seized on this moment to launch a full-scale attack.
Part of the issue is also that Congress, in a bipartisan manner, has made it easier for states to crack down on the free speech rights of Americans if they support the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. It's a Palestinian-led struggle to hold Israel accountable. And this is the BDS movement is one that Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib have also expressed support for. So do these two women, and especially Ilhan Omar, since she's the one in the crossfire right now, crosshairs right now, does she represent all of these things that threaten U.S. and Israel's cozy relationship that depends on the oppression of Palestinians?
Well, let's face it, we have a long ways to go before that cozy and what I would say is an incredibly unhealthy relationship for both countries is endangered. Israel is still continuing to receive $3.8 billion a year from the U.S. U.S. weapons companies and Israeli weapons companies have a cozy relationship. These are the first beginning stages of the door opening where we're seeing more criticism of Israel and support for Palestinian rights. And we have here the leaders of just that little crack in the door being attacked brutally. You referred to the anti-BDS legislation. So that has passed through the Senate side of Congress. But word is that it's going to have a very difficult time on the House side. And that's thanks to people like Ilhan Omar.
And it's in a way, it was Glenn Greenwald's reference to that legislation that Ilhan Omar then retweeted and that started all of this this spat. Do you think it that she should have stood firm? I mean, you know, if real racists like Steve King can hold on to their real racism and refuse to apologize, it's sort of sad that a genuine progressive like Ilhan Omar, who made a statement that you don't consider racist, had to capitulate.
Absolutely. She should have been able to continue getting down to the very important business. We're heading towards a vote on the House side to invoke the War Powers Act and end U.S. support and some of the U.S. support for the Saudi-led war in Yemen. She should be doing her job, and her job is to do the important work of Congress, the important work of the Foreign Affairs Committee, and she never should have been taken from that.
How effectively has Israel and pro-Israel propagandists here in the U.S. been able to equate all criticism of Israel and its actions against Palestinians as anti-Semitic? I mean, this also seems to fall very squarely in that space, and it seems to be a very effective tool for shutting down established members of Congress.
Well, we've seen some really major attacks in the past year. We saw initially an award be revoked from Angela Davis thanks to grassroots pressure.
Right.
That award was reinstated. We saw Mark Lamont Hill lose his position. So we've seen as a CNN consultant. So we've seen a lot of this. But what we're also seeing, I want to speak about the hopeful side, is enormous amount of grassroots pressure, like in the case of Angela Davis, to say that support for Palestinian rights is part of a comprehensive progressive platform and is in no way anti-Semitic. We've also seen major shifts in American Jewish opinion, moving away from support for the occupation and towards a stand for Palestinian rights. So while this is, you know, a disheartening time, we are overall moving in the right direction. And, you know, I'm so glad that we have these women in Congress that are taking these brave stands.
Now, the situation of Ilhan Omar, Mark Lamont Hill, and Angela Davis, all three of them that you mentioned, are all Black Americans. Is there a racial component here that you are noticing, that Black Americans who have in, you know, past decade or so really found common cause with Palestinians and Palestinian rights, with Ilhan Omar, it might also be her Muslim faith, have been attacked even more strongly?
Sure. This is not a coincidence. We began to see alliances between Black solidarity and Palestinian solidarity around the time of Ferguson, when the community in Ferguson took notice that these are the same experiences that Palestinians have under occupation. And a lot of this is due to the deadly exchange of U.S. police training with the Israeli military, as well as the deadly exchange of U.S. weapons between U.S. weapons companies and Israeli weapons companies like Elbit Systems. So as this growing solidarity has been developing, it's a huge threat to the forces of the status quo. And so it's not at all a coincidence that these attacks are coming against Black people, against Muslim women, people of color.
And the media, in their coverage of Ilhan Omar's story in particular, are not, I feel, effectively reminding us of the virulent Islamophobic attacks on her during her campaign for Congress and even after she won, before her inauguration and throughout the first month of her tenure as a freshman congresswoman. She has been the target of some horrific Islamophobic attacks that no one's apologized for.
Absolutely. What we know right now is that American Jews have an enormous amount of power. And I would say that with that power, and as an American Jew myself, comes a huge responsibility. And that responsibility that we have is to use our power to recognize such forces as Islamophobia. And if we, as American Jews, spent just a fraction of the time that we spend looking for anti-Semitism, for false things of anti-Semitism from the left, instead devoting that to stamping out Islamophobia and anti-Black racism, we would make enormous progress that would ensure safety for all people. As an American Jew, I know very well that it will never be through forces like Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu that Jews find safety from anti-Semitism, which is genuinely on the rise. It's by working against all forms of racism that we find that safety. It's through solidarity.
So the anti-Semitism that we've seen on the rise here in the United States has been documented by groups like the Southern Poverty Law Center, the Anti-Defamation League, which has its own set of problems. Of course, it's a problematic organization, but it has noted a very strong uptick in anti-Semitic hate crimes as well. We had the horrific synagogue shooting in Philadelphia, and we have people who claim allegiance to Trump marching alongside neo-Nazis Nazis in places like Charlottesville. So it's really remarkable that you have this firestorm over Ilhan Omar when the actual rise of anti-Semitism isn't being properly identified and denounced. If you were to give Omar advice, what would you tell her and other critics of Israel in Congress, whose every word is going to be watched, how she should remain true to her critique of AIPAC, of the State of Israel, and effectively respond to charges of anti-Semitism?
Well, first, I just want to point out that even the Anti-Defamation League, which, as you've said, has some problematic elements of their agenda, even they have recognized that virtually all of the anti-Semitic attacks that we have seen as anti-Semitism is on the rise are coming from the far right, from white nationalism. They are not coming from this supposed false threat of anti-Semitism from the left. So what I would encourage, say to Ilhan Omar, and we were actually at her office, Code Pink was, to give support and thank her for her brave positions. But what I would encourage her is just to remain strong and stand by her principles and to know that her community is behind her, that we have her back, and we're so grateful for the work that she's doing.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Ariel, for joining us today. Give out the website for Code Pink.
It's codepink.org.
And we'll post a link to that from our site. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Ariel Gold is the national co-director of Code Pink. She manages the organization's campaigns for Palestinian rights. We've been discussing Ilhan Omar's recent comments on Israel and how they are being interpreted as anti-Semitic. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Gets Up. Like us on facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
Radio is proud to co-sponsor the live performance of the West Lynn Radio Hour, KWL 1956, on Saturday, March 16th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Youth Music Project in West Lynn. For the past 3 years, the West Lynn Historical Society has produced the KWL radio show. This year, the reenactment will feature a roundup of the news, West Lynn history on parade, as the Willamette Flow soap opera, and more. Again, that's a live performance of the West Lynn Radio Hour, KWL 1956, on Saturday, March 16th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Youth Music Project, 2015 8th Avenue in West Lynn. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of a live performance by Antonio Rey on Thursday, March 7th from 7:30 to 9:30 p.m. at the Old Church Concert Hall in Portland. Antonio Rey is one of the leading flamenco guitarists of Spain today. Rey will be with flamenco dancer and singer Mara Rey. Again, that's Antonio Rey on Thursday, March 7th from 7:30 to 9:30 p.m. at the Old Church Concert Hall, 1422 Southwest 11th in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hey, 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 what is going on out there? It's 8 o'clock, KBOO Portland. Time now for another edition of Drinking from Puddles, no matter where you're listening, whether it be in the Hood River, Columbia Gorge area at 91.9 FM, Philomath, Corvallis, Albany, 104.3 FM, here in Portland, Oregon at 90.7 FM, or worldwide at www.kboo.fm. Welcome. Time now, yes, for another edition of the show, Drinking from Puddles. I'm Brandon, and tonight's Drinking from Puddles program is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Hopworks Urban Brewery, offering sustainable brews and local food for 10 years, serving the community at three locations: Hopworks Urban Brewery on Southeast Powell Boulevard, Bike Bar at North Williams Avenue, and in Vancouver on Southeast Mill Plain Boulevard. More information online at hopworksbeer.com.